This is podcast number 26 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm sharing lessons from Brave Little Holland. Brave Little Holland and What She Taught Us is the title of a 1922 book I'm taking most of my information from to share with you today. William Griffiths wrote it because he wanted to teach the boys and girls of America the lessons in liberty Holland left us. As John Adams wrote, "The originals of the two republics are so much alike that the history of one seems but a transcript from that of the other. The Dutch cast off the yoke of the Spaniards just as our fathers threw off the yoke of the British, because their rights were invaded and they were taxed without their consent. Like our fathers also, they first formed a union of states and then made themselves free by a declaration of independence. Like us, they had a long war for freedom. Ours was 8 years, theirs was 80. Like us, they had troubled about threatened secession. They talked a lot about state rights and the Union, but the Union was maintained. Only they were 200 years ahead of us. The Dutch even fly a flag of red, white, and blue." Let me start by painting a little picture for you of the spirit of these Dutch people, taken from M.B. Singh's version in The Awakening of Europe. The fight for freedom had been going on for many years. City after city had been attacked and fallen. The Spanish Duke of Alva taunted them. "Like a hen calling her chickens, His Majesty still seeks to gather you all under the parental wing. But if you will not, every city in the Netherlands shall be burned to the ground." The Siege of Leyden began in October of 1573. It was October 1574 when it ended. And all through this long, dreary year, the Dutchmen inside the town were fighting with famine and starvation, fighting for their religious liberty and freedom from the Spanish tyranny. In the very center of Leyden rose an old tower standing high above the surrounding low country. From it could be seen the broad, fertile fields which once had lain under the sea, and little villages with their bright gardens and fruitful orchards. As the long months wore on, their condition became desperate. They were starving, but they would not yield, for if Leyden fell, Holland fell too. Yet what could be done? The Prince of Orange, William the Silent, knew what could be done. Better a drowned land than a lost land. If nothing else could save the city, the dikes could be opened and the great stormy sea would once more ebb and flow over the country. Holland would be ruined, but at least it would not be in the hands of the Spaniards. "We have held out as long as we can," wrote the starving citizens. "Human strength can do no more." Then the prince went himself and had the great dikes bored in 16 places. The water gates were opened, and the water began slowly to pour over the flat land. The good news was carried into the despairing city. The citizens took fresh heart. Leyden, their city, would yet be saved. The besiegers, too, heard the news of the cutting of the dikes, but they did not believe in the possibility of the sea getting up so far as Leyden. "Go up to the tower, ye beggars," they laughed. "Go up to the tower and tell us if you can see the ocean coming over the dry land to your relief." And day after day, the citizens crept up the old ruined tower and strained their eyes out over the sea, watching, hoping, praying, fearing, and at last almost despairing of relief by God or man. Meanwhile, the prince lay in a burning fever at Rotterdam. Under the strain of the last months, he had broken down. In his fever, he seemed to hear the cries of the starving citizens. Would they give in before the ships could sail to their relief? It was the 1st of September when the sea beggars embarked in their shallow boats on the water that was now slowly rising over the land. The little fleet made its way over 15 miles of flooded country between the seacoast and Leyden. So far, a favorable wind had blown them onwards. Now the wind changed. The waters began to sink, and despair once more fell on the starving people within Leyden. They had eaten everything now. They had boiled the leaves of trees and eaten roots. Women and children dropped down dead in the streets. The burghers could hardly drag their weary legs up to the watchtower, yet they would not give up. Leyden was sublime in her despair. They must be true to their charge, true to their prince, true to their country. The old burgomaster of the town spoke to the wavering from time to time. "My life is at your disposal," he said one day. "Here is my sword. Plunge it into me and divide my flesh among you, but expect no surrender as long as I live." "As well," shouted the angry Spaniards, "as well can the Prince of Orange pluck the stars from the sky as bring the ocean to the walls of Leyden." On the 1st of October, a violent gale swept over the waste of waters from the northwest. The waters rose rapidly, and the sea beggars sailed proudly forward in the darkness of the night. Within the town, all was mysterious. Would the Spaniards attack them or flee? Must they yet perish in sight of help? But before morning had dawned, the Spanish host had grown alarmed at the rapidly rising waters and the crews of wild, fierce sailors sailing ever nearer and nearer. And before the waters reached them, they had crept away under cover of the darkness. A long line of moving lights were seen to flit across the black face of the waters at dead of night, and when day dawned, at last there was not a Spaniard left. So the sea beggars sailed to Leyden, and the city was saved. In honor of the bravery of Leyden's citizens, the story says, the Prince of Orange offered to free them of their taxes for 2 years or to build them a university. Because of their love of learning, they chose the university, and Leyden University became the foremost institution of learning in all of Europe for a season. The Prince of Orange, or William the Silent, as he is called for reasons you will learn of, is a life worth studying. Take note that William was taught by his mother, Juliana of Stolberg, a woman of rare abilities and a deeply religious character. He took the stand, "I cannot approve of monarchs who want to rule over the conscience of people and take away their freedom of choice and religion." In 1577, he wrote these words to the Dutch magistrates that became the cornerstone first of the Dutch and then the American Republic. "We declare to you that you have no right to interfere with the conscience of anyone so long as he has done nothing that works injury to another person or a public scandal." A people who were seeking God, each after his own way, seemed to be good to him. He believed that they all, being children of one father, should live lovingly together as his children. He hated persecution and cruelty done in the name of religion. This was in the days of the terrible Inquisition, and an era when hundreds of thousands were put to their deaths or tortured for their religious beliefs. No wonder Holland became a place of temporary refuge to the pilgrims until they could find a permanent safe haven in the New World. In modern days, you find Corrie ten Boom and her family hiding Jewish refugees, thereby endangering their own lives. And Holland was the place Anne Frank's Jewish German family fled to for safety. Brave little Holland is ridiculously small. And before we go on, no, Holland is not a country. It's one of 11 provinces of the Netherlands. It's like what Texas is to the United States. I'm posting a little 3-minute video in the podcast notes to help clear up any confusion or possibly to keep you confused. But Holland plays such an important role in their history, her name is frequently the one we hear. The whole kingdom of the Netherlands, 11 provinces, is less than half the size of South Carolina, a third the area of Ohio, and barely bigger than Maryland. You can drop 20 Netherlands into the state of Texas. But don't let her size fool you as to her power or her influence. Good things do come in small packages. As Benjamin Franklin wrote, "In love of liberty and bravery in the defense of it, she has been our greatest example." Holland provided the training ground for such illustrious soldiers as Sir Walter Raleigh, Captain John Smith, and Miles Standish. When Alva's army arrived from Spain, tens of thousands of Dutch's best fled to England, and not a few of these Dutch refugees emigrated to America. Some of the bluest blood of New England was Dutch before it was English. 4 of our original 13 colonies were settled by the Dutch. In our Revolutionary War, the Dutch sympathized with us, gave us aid, and lent us money. Her brave officers came to fight with us and for us. After the United States was formally recognized, the loan of Dutch merchants of $14 million came when our country needed it most. When in 1787 our fathers made the Constitution, the Dutch Republic was the living example before their eyes. They borrowed many things directly from the Dutch system, though they also rejected many and improved most of its features. Alexander Hamilton, who married a Dutch woman, was a scholar of Dutch history and applied many of those lessons in laying the foundation of America. For 1,000 years, the Dutch fought the sea and diked the land. Once a mud hole, by genius, energy, patience, and faith of a noble people, the mud hole has been changed into a garden. Nederland means the land beneath, as in a land beneath the ocean. The names of some of her famous cities, like Amsterdam and Rotterdam, or Amsterdam, as they would say it, and Rotterdam, are so named for the dams placed on the rivers so that cities could be built. Many of the arts, sciences, inventions, and improvements which made Great Britain so rich and powerful came from Holland. The cookie is of Dutch origin, and of course the Dutch oven. A taste for flowers was introduced at the time of the Crusades, and the Dutch became a nation of flower lovers and skilled gardeners. As many as 24 editions of the New Testament and 15 editions of the Bible had been printed and published in the Netherlands before one copy had been printed in England. A Dutch golden age followed their victory for freedom. Like a moth is drawn to the flame of a candle, the light of freedom drew some of Europe's greatest thinkers, scientists, writers, and artists to Holland, where they were allowed freedom of thought and expression, where faith and reason, art and science, heart and mind could thrive. It was in this golden age that the art of the Republic glorified the home. Instead of painting winged angels, mysteries, nuns, and popes, they transfigured on the canvas the joys of pure wedded life, the mother, the baby in the cradle, their lovely meadows, and their glorious sunsets. In this golden age, over 1 million paintings were created in a span of just 20 years, although few have survived. Every home displayed works of art on their walls, celebrating their love of life and joy in common things. The central role of woman revolved around the home during this golden age. She delighted in the arts of homemaking and creating a safe haven from the lack of Christian virtue and immorality often found outside the home. They believed that so goes the home, so goes the republic. Older women were looked up to and respected for their wisdom by the younger women. By the time our republic was being born, the Republic of the Netherlands was dying. We would be wise to note some of the reasons for their decline. Do you recognize any of these among us, as described by Griffiths? There was too much concentration into the central government. The political machinery became clogged and at times almost suffered paralysis. Among the people, a spirit of luxury and extravagance took hold. They became weakened in old earnestness, integrity, devotion to high principles, sound ideas of honor, reverence for women, frugality and temperance. A money-loving spirit increased. Religion became formal. Manners declined. The love of strong liquors increased. Commerce, credit, the navy and army declined. The virtues of republican faith in God, high motives, grand actions, and simplicity in dress, food, and life had fallen to common levels. So is there any hope for us? Can we turn things around? The more you study history, the more you see the cycles of history repeat themselves. As Lord Byron noted, there is the moral of all human tales. 'Tis but the same rehearsed of the past. First freedom, then glory. When that fails, wealth, vice, corruption. barbarism at last, and history with all her volumes vast hath but one page. Where will the spirit of freedom be born again that will give a generation the courage and stamina to stand up to tyranny in the face of starvation, sacrifice, and death, as our friends at Leyden did that I shared at the beginning of this podcast? Change always begins in the heart of one man or woman, such as Gerhard Groot, who was born in 1340, who preached a religion independent of priests and church despotism, and instead set people in search for inner peace. The priests weren't happy with him and revoked his license to preach. So he opened a private school and began the copying and multiplication of books. He revived many schools that had fallen in decay, where young men flocked, eager for knowledge. The people respected the fact that he earned his own living and worked with his own hands. He was a light to them, and his sincere example ignited an educational movement that was rooted in the hearts of the common people who vied with each other to support it. Families gladly boarded poor students without cost. Although he died when he was only 45 years old, others picked up the work and raised up a generation of Christian patriots in the Netherlands. These men, full of hope for the future, fond of books, with minds well-trained, hungry for that food for the soul, furnished the intellectual stamina for the great struggle of the 16th century against giant Spain. Pupils of Groot became some of the best teachers of Europe, and notice this, he brought back the old stories and reintroduced the reading of the old struggles for freedom in the ancient republics, thereby firing anew thoughts and desires for freedom. Are you not doing the same thing as you fill the hearts of your children with the stories of the brave and the great and the noble, preparing a generation for the fight ahead which history teaches us is looming? The stories of brave little Holland will help fill that reservoir. You can learn much about the Dutch people and their history from Mary Mapes Dodge's book, Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates, based on a true story. Younger children may not have the patience to sit through the history parts, but your middle schoolers and older will learn much about Dutch history and their people, which was intentional on Mary Dodge's part. In her preface, she wrote, "Should it cause even one heart to feel a deeper trust in God's goodness and love, the prayer with which it was begun and ended will have been answered." Also, I'll link another book of hers in the podcast notes called The Land of Pluck. I was meeting with a group of young women and their leaders a while back, and we were trying to come up with some stories of courage and bravery, and I suggested the story of the little boy of Haarlem, which is the capital of North Holland, the true story of a little boy who saved his village by holding his finger in the dike. I was astonished to learn that not one girl or mother in that group had ever even heard of the story. So in my effort to keep it out there, I'll close today's podcast with the story put to a poem, The Leak in the Dike by Phoebe Carey. The good dame looked from her cottage at the close of the pleasant day and cheerily called to her little son outside the door at play. "Come, Peter, come. I want you to go while there is light to see to the hut of the blind old man who lives across the dikes for me, and take these cakes I made for him. They are hot and smoking yet. You have time enough to go and come before the sun is set." Then the good wife turned to her labor, humming a simple song, and thought of her husband working hard at the sluices all day long, and set the turf a-blazing and brought the coarse black bread, that he might find a fire at night and find the table spread. And Peter left the brother with whom all day he had played, and the sister who had watched their sports in the willow's tender shade, and now with his face all glowing and eyes as bright as the day, with the thoughts of his pleasant errand he trudged along the way. And soon his joyous prattle made glad a lonesome place. Alas, if only the blind old man could have seen that happy face. Yet he somehow caught the brightness which his voice and presence lent, and he felt the sunshine come and go as Peter came and went. And now, as the day was sinking and the winds began to rise, the mother looked from her door again, shading her anxious eyes, and saw the shadows deepen and birds to their homes come back, but never a sign of Peter along the level track. But she said, "He will come at morning, so I need not fret or grieve, though it isn't like my boy at all to stay without my leave." But where was the child delaying? On the homeward way was he, and across the dike, while the sun was up an hour above the sea, he was stopping now to gather flowers, now listening to the sound as the angry waters dashed themselves against their narrow bound. "Ah, well for us," said Peter, "that the gates are good and strong, and my father tends them carefully, or they would not hold you long." "You're a wicked sea," said Peter. "I know why you fret and chafe. You would like to spoil our lands and homes, but our sluices keep you safe." But hark! Through the noise of waters comes a low, clear, trickling sound, and the child's face pales with terror, and his blossoms drop to the ground. He is up at the bank in a moment, and stealing through the sand, he sees a stream not yet so large as his slender, childish hand. 'Tis a leak in the dike! He is but a boy, unused to fearful scenes. But young as he is, he has learned to know the dreadful thing that means. A leak in the dike! The stoutest heart grows faint that cry to hear, and the bravest man in all the land turns white with mortal fear. For he knows the smallest leak may grow to a flood in a single night, and he knows the strength of the cruel sea when loosed in its angry might. And the boy, he has seen the danger, and shouting a wild alarm, he forces back the weight of the sea with the strength of his single arm. He listens for the joyful sound of a footstep passing nigh, and lays his ear to the ground to catch the answer to his cry. And he hears the rough winds blowing and the waters rise and fall, but never an answer comes to him save the echo of his call. He sees no hope, no succor. His feeble voice is lost. Yet what shall he do but watch and wait, though he perish at his post? So faintly calling and crying till the sun is under the sea, crying and moaning till the stars come out for company, he thinks of his brother and sister asleep in their safe warm bed. He thinks of his father and mother, of himself as dying and dead, and of how, when the night is over, they must come and find him at last. But he never thinks he can leave the place where duty holds him fast. The good dame in the cottage is up and astir with a light, for the thought of her little Peter has been with her all night. And now she watches the pathway, as yestereve she had done. But what does she see so strange and black against the rising sun? Her neighbors are bearing between them something straight to her door. Her child is coming home, but not as he ever came before. "He is dead," she cries, "my darling." And the startled father hears and comes and looks the way she looks and fears the thing she fears, till a glad shout from the bearers thrills the stricken man and wife. "Give thanks, for your son has saved our land, and God has saved his life." So there in the morning sunshine, they knelt about the boy, and every head was bared and bent in tearful, reverent joy. 'Tis many a year since then, but still when the sea roars like a flood, their boys are taught what a boy can do who is brave and true and good. For every man in that country takes his son by the hand and tells him of little Peter, whose courage saved the land. They have many a valiant hero remembered through the years, but never one whose name so oft is named with loving tears. And his deed shall be sung by the cradle and told to the children on the knee, so long as the dikes of Holland divide the land from the sea. Bye-bye. See you next time.